Thank you. Please be seated.
This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center versus Donald Lautzenheiser, next friend of Stephen Luke Lautzenheiser from Dallas County and the 5th Appellate Judicial District. Dallas County Community College District and others versus William H. Bolton III and others from Dallas County and the 5th Appellate Judicial District. And Marcus Martinez and others versus Val Verde Regional Medical Center, also known as Val Verde County Hospital District, from Val Verde County and the 4th Appellate Judicial District. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising our marshal. We will take a recess in between each argument and complete the arguments before noon. You may purchase a tape of any of these arguments for a small fee from the clerk of our court. Justice Wainwright is away today attending a family funeral, but he will participate in the deliberation and decision in these cases. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in UT Medical Center versus Lautzenheiser.
May it please the court, Mr. Ryan will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner deserves 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This court should conclude that the notice provision of the Texas Tort Claims Act is a jurisdictional prerequisite to the state's waiver of sovereign immunity under the Act. And because the plaintiff in this case did not comply with the notice provision, the court should render judgment dismissing plaintiff's claims for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. This court recently recognized in Wichita Falls State Hospital versus Taylor, citing Federalist 81 by Alexander Hamilton, that it is in the nature of sovereignty not to be amenable to suit without its consent. And this is an exemption enjoyed by every state in the Union. Accordingly, this court held back in 1847 in Hosner versus DeYoung, and again in 1936 in State v. Isbell, that the state of Texas cannot be sued without its consent, and then only in the manner indicated by that consent. The manner indicated by that consent in this case is the Texas Tort Claims Act, and specifically Section 101.101, the Notice Provision, which entitles a state entity to 6 months to notice within 6 months of an incident alleged to have caused an injury to a plaintiff. Because, as the court held in Texas Department of Transportation versus Jones, a trial court is without subject matter jurisdiction over a suit against the state without its consent, and then the manner of the state's consent must also limit a trial court's jurisdiction. Because in this case, the notice provision is a part of the manner in which the state legislature has indicated its consent to sue, it must necessarily follow that the notice provision also limits a trial court's jurisdiction to hear suits against the state.
Counsel, we've in the past said that to determine whether the legislature intended a provision to be jurisdictional, we look at such things as the presence or absence of specific consequences in the statute for noncompliance. In other words, there, in this case, there is no consequence that is mandated by the statute that says unless you provide notice within 6 months, the cause is subject to dismissal. Why shouldn't we apply that same thinking to this case?
Well, for the first reason is the one that I just stated, which is that the court has stated, and it is inherent in the doctrine of sovereign immunity jurisprudence, that a state can only be sued with its consent, and then only in the manner indicated by that consent. And this is the manner indicated by that consent.
Which case says only in the manner, if, in other words, every condition put on it has to be fulfilled before jurisdiction comes into place?
Hosner versus DeYoung, which is 1 Texas 764 at 769, says, quote, no state can be sued in her own courts without her consent, and then only in the manner indicated by that consent.
So, you know, the new thing in the legislature is to tell us not only the limitations periods, but several statutes tell us exactly how the case should be submitted to the jury. In other words, whose name should be in the jury question and whose not. Presume the legislature could do that, could have a procedure saying how the jury charge is drawn up, right? And if they did, then your argument is, because that's one of many procedures in the Tort Claims Act, court has jurisdiction when it's filed to do discovery, to try the case, but if you submit it wrong, poof, jurisdiction goes away at the end of the trial.
Because it is the manner of...
I mean, they can tell us to try it that way. They can tell us when to file it. But do we really want jurisdiction to go in and out like that? And I suppose if we reverse it and send it back and they submit it right this time, then jurisdiction comes back.
Well, they couldn't submit it right in this case because the notice provision has already expired.
So my question is, is every procedural matter put in the Texas Tort Claims Act jurisdictional?
Yes, Your Honor.
Everyone.
Because those are indications of the state's consent to sue, they should be considered jurisdictional. However, the state could also decide that curable restrictions on the waiver of sovereign immunity from suit could be non-jurisdictional. One possible way that the court could decide that would be in following the position of Essenberg, which said that a presentment clause, which could be cured by abatement, could later then... be complied with and then not be, and therefore not be jurisdictional.
What are the consequences for the finality of judgments if we say that this is jurisdictional? Suppose a governmental entity did not raise the notice issue and the case was tried. Is that judgment subject to collateral attack on down the line is void because the trial court didn't have jurisdiction?
As all restrictions, because subject matter jurisdiction can be raised at any time, just like the use and property requirements of the Tort Claims Act, a state could raise that at any time.
Why isn't the San Antonio Court of Appeals decision in Martinez more well-reasoned on that score in terms of finality of judgments and not being able to rummage through old judgments and look up and see if notice requirements were met?
In Martinez versus Valverde Hospital, is that the case that the court is referring to? Well, in that case, the court did say that the notice provision was... In that case, the court said that the notice provision was not jurisdictional. But that would be inconsistent with the doctrine of sovereign immunity, which says that that a state can raise sovereign immunity at any time because courts have no subject matter jurisdiction against the state without their consent.
Why is it sovereign immunity... destroyed because you win by summary judgment rather than plead to the jurisdiction?
Well, the reason that it matters that it's jurisdictional is for a variety of reasons. First and foremost, it would be that the state can raise it at any time in the course of the proceedings, so that it wouldn't be waived if the state didn't bring it up at the beginning of trial or even during trial. But secondly, this is a matter of the state's limited resources. If you require the state to subject itself to discovery and even possibly a long, expensive trial over a suit that the state has not waived its sovereign immunity, then the court is subjecting the state to expenditures that the legislature chose the state not to be subjected to.
But in a case that's going to have issues regarding notice, whether it's jurisdictional or a matter of affirmative defense subject to summary judgment, you're going to still have to do that discovery anyway. I mean, I guess the only real difference it makes is that it will subject these judgments to collateral attack. Otherwise, you can get a summary judgment heard just as quickly. It disposes of it just as well. But the only difference then is going to be that you're going to have judgments that are out there subject to collateral attack down the road. Would that be right?
In those limited cases in which the notice provision is a fact issue, that may be correct. But there are a great number of cases which the notice provision is not a fact issue. Specifically in this one, for example, it is uncontested that notice was not provided within 6 months of the incident alleged to have caused the injury.
But why would summary judgment not take care of that just as well? I guess that's why I'm confused.
Because that may occur down the road that a court rules in summary judgment. It is also a matter of whether the state could appeal. Because the state cannot appeal a denial of summary judgment on jurisdictional grounds on an interlocutory basis. So if the trial court incorrectly ruled that it was that the notice provision was complied with, then the state would have to subject itself to an entire suit. Whereas if the trial court incorrectly rules that the notice provision has been complied with, and it is a jurisdictional matter, then the state has an immediate interlocutory appeal to end the suit at that state without the expense of a full-fledged trial.
Looking at the statute, it talks in terms of entitlement. It says a governmental unit is entitled to receive notice of a claim. That suggests that perhaps it's something that can be waived. Is that correct? correct. It doesn't say that the trial court can only exercise jurisdiction if.
I don't think that it necessarily follows that subject matter jurisdiction or that the notice provision could be waived just because it says that it is entitled to. Especially when you look at section 101.025, which says that sovereign immunity to suit is waived and abolished to the extent liability is created by this chapter. This court held in Cathy versus Booth that liability is not created by the chapter if a plaintiff does not comply with the notice provision. So based on the plain language of the statute, 101.025, it must be that sovereign immunity from suit is not waived if you do not comply with the notice provision. Otherwise, the court would have to reverse Cathy versus Booth and say that it is not true that liability from suit is not waived if someone fails to comply.
There are cases to which we've alluded where notice is a very difficult issue. For example, in actual notice cases, and there's a great deal of uncertainty about what state employees knew, when they knew it, and what they knew about what was happening. It's hard to think of those kinds of issues in jurisdictional terms, but your position requires that they be treated that way. Is that right?
That's correct, Justice. This is essentially very similar to the use and property requirements in that it restricts the class of claims over which the state has waived its sovereign immunity from suit so that some will fall within and some will fall outside of the class of claims. And just like the use and property provisions, as this court has held on multiple occasions, such as Texas Department of Criminal Justice versus Miller and Texas Natural Resources Conservation Commission versus White, that those use and property requirements are jurisdictional restrictions on suit. And Justice O'Neill, just like those use and property requirements, there will sometimes be factual concerns that the court will not be able to dispose of immediately. But that does not affect whether or not those provisions are jurisdictional. It just affects whether or not the court will be able to make a legal determination of whether those jurisdictional prerequisites have been complied with.
How do we square your position with Dubai?
That's a very good question. And the reason is that the legal rationale in Dubai is that the trial court has inherent subject matter jurisdiction over suits against private parties. Therefore, the trial court will automatically have jurisdiction against suits between private parties. And thus, it wouldn't matter whether a litigant complied with a statutory prerequisite to a cause of action involving private parties because the trial court would already have jurisdiction over the matter. In this case, as the court recognized in Texas Department of Transportation versus Jones, trial courts do not have inherent subject matter jurisdiction over suits against the states. Therefore, you must comply with the statutory provisions in order to invoke the trial court's subject matter jurisdiction. Moreover, in this case, it is uncontested the plaintiff did not comply with the notice provision. Specifically, the plaintiffs allege that their injuries or the incident alleged to have caused their injuries occurred in January 21st and January 28th of 1992. The plaintiff Lutzenheiser, however, did not file his complaint until December 16th of 1994, almost 3 years later. So that was the first formal written notice of any possible complaint against the defendant.
Do you say that the parents could give notice on behalf of the child?
Yes, Your Honor. Moreover, the only informal, non-written notice was given almost 8 months after the birth of the child, which was a telephone call from the child's father on September 1st of 1992. Therefore, it is uncontested that there was no notice given to the university in this case within 6 months of the incident alleged to have caused the injury to the plaintiff.
And you'd acknowledge that's a bit of a perverse result. Your claim then expires before you even know it exists.
It's not that the claim expires, because according to the court's jurisprudence right now, there is no cause of action until the birth of the child. It's not that the claim expires, it's that the notice provision runs, because the notice provision is tied to the date of the injury.
Well, but I guess I'm saying the claim is defeated before it's even known.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And how do you square that with, how do you address their equal protection argument?
Well, first and foremost, there can be no equal protection violation with regard to the status of a fetus because there is no discrimination based on whether the person is a fetus in this case, because the notice provision runs against all parties, any plaintiffs. It does not make a class of persons for whom the notice provision runs against. Indeed, this was recognized a long time ago in, for example, Stanford versus Texas A&M University at 680 Southwest 2nd, 650. When a plaintiff was exposed to a pesticide in 1975, and the plaintiff and doctors diagnosed an injury based on exposure to that pesticide in 1980, 5 years later, and the Beaumont Court of Appeals correctly decided that it is the plain language of the notice provision says you only get 6 months from the alleged incident. It is indeed unfair, as Justice O'Neill seems to assert, but that doesn't make it one in which the court can force the state legislature to waive sovereign immunity. Indeed, the court recently wrote in Dallas Area Rapid Transit versus Whitley that we recognize that the plaintiff suffered terrible injuries and that it is unlikely he will recover any meaningful compensation for them under the tort system. But the legislature has enacted only a limited waiver of sovereign immunity, and the terms of that waiver do not permit the plaintiff to recover against the state. Therefore, the court reversed the judgment of the Court of Appeals and dismissed the case for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. And again,
I think I heard you just say that the first informal notice came 8 months after birth.
No, 8 months after the alleged incident to have caused it.
And 16 days after birth.
I didn't count the days, Your Honor, but I trust your calculation. So therefore, Justice O'Neill, it may indeed be unfair. However, because the inherent nature of sovereign immunity is unfair, because some claims are waived and some claims are not permitted, then that is the choice of the legislature, and that's the decision of the legislature in this case. Moreover, there is a rational basis with regard to the Equal Protection Clause, even if there was some discrimination based on status of the fetus, which there clearly is not in this case, because there's a broader group of claims for which sovereign immunity is not waived. But even if there were, there's clearly a rational basis for the notice provision, and that is, as the court wrote in Cathy versus Booth, that it permits the state to protect against unfounded claims, to preserve evidence, to settle claims, and to prepare for trial. Moreover, it also permits the state to write a clear, bright-line rule to say that if you do not give us notice within 6 months of the incident alleged to have caused the injury, the state can move on and the legislature can expend resources and direct its resources elsewhere. This is the policy choice of the legislature. And because sovereign immunity is a constitutional principle, the court should not use another constitutional principle to force the legislature to do something that it has the inherent constitutional right not to do.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Thomas Blakely will present argument to the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honor. Mr. Justice Gonzalez, concurring in Nelson, wrote, "It is my hope that the courts and legislatures of this nation and our society will continue to ponder the meaning and value of life, even that of those yet unborn. Through this process of reflection and discussion, hopefully the pendulum of public opinion will swing toward the recognition of the rights of the unborn." Judge Godbee, in effect, recognized that right at the trial level when, in distinguishing the case of Prider from the present case, he found that Prider was factually distinguishable because it involved an action that occurred while the This case involves an action occurred while the mother was pregnant, not simply while the child was a minor, and thus refused to apply the notice provision as being applicable to the child. He did so on the basis of the determination that to do so would in fact be an unconstitutional infringement upon the child's right for a remedy. That is implicit in his holding. I'm not suggesting that he determined that, but there could be no other reason that I can conceive that would allow such a determination by Judge Godbee at the trial level.
Have you found other cases that discussed how the right to the remedy worked in a claim that's common law in nature but is brought against the sovereign? who is entitled constitutionally to sovereign immunity, as opposed to a claim for a common law right, for a common law assertion against a private person?
Well, Your Honor, the common law right for a claim based on a prenatal injury, as this court determined in Yandell's back in the early 70s, is a right that has been preserved, and I'd be the first to admit that the issue of whether or not the Texas Tort Claims Act in fact creates a statutory right of action, or whether or not it simply revives a common law right to proceed, is somewhat unclear. I mean, there is no case directly on point. Therefore, the issue of whether or not this may be an
open... We tried to settle that in Cathy. There's no creation of a right here.
That's true, but...
It really removes a disability.
Yes, right.
But my question... I mean, if this were against a private hospital, then we would be looking at open court jurisprudence.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But it's not against a private hospital. It's against the state. And do we have authority about how that right to a remedy jurisprudence operates when you have this other constitutional principle on the other hand?
I think it boils down, and my response to that would be that we must look at equal protection as the principle that's being violated here, and I think contrary to the suggestion by my learned opponent, the issue is that this statute, in fact, or the notice provision of the statute, in fact, creates a subclass of Texas citizens, unborn children injured prenatally, who in fact do not even become persons under the law of Texas until they're born. It unlawfully, I believe, discriminates against them, because what justification is served by the purpose of the statute? How
does it have the same effect against claimants who don't know that they've been injured?
Well, that's true, and I've thought about that, Your Honor. The arguable difference is that there, first of all, is an existence of a person who has at least the opportunity to have some type of representation, for example, with a mentally incompetent, an alert guardian, perhaps as a matter of prudence, could provide notice in a timely fashion. The unborn child whose 6 months expires in utero doesn't have that opportunity, and that does not serve the purpose of the statute, which is the idea of settling claims, preparing for trial.
So you're comfortable with the discovery rule, but not with this application of the statute against the fetus.
That's correct, Your Honor. And my point to even further refine it in that regard would be at the moment of birth, which is when I believe that 6 months should be triggered, that would not be a discovery principle. That's, in fact, under Texas law, that's when the person, and how can you have a personal injury such as enumerated in the Texas statute, created until in fact you have a person. And the incident is actually the date of birth, and it's not a discovery principle, it's simply that's when the cause of action that could exist in fact begins to exist.
Do you think that the state could just refuse to waive immunity for suits for injuries to fetuses?
I think so. I think that
they could just pick them out and say, you know, we're going to waive immunity for suits for injuries to people who are born, but not for injury to fetuses.
I think they could do that.
How is that any worse than this?
Well, it would be worse because it would obviously indicate the intent. I mean, I think that the legislature here has obviously created a situation where they're not obviously intending to exclude fetuses, but we must look at the net result of that. In fact, there is a de facto, by virtue of the fact that human pregnancy is 9 months long, so exclusion of this class of children.
If the legislature's mean, that's okay, but if they're stupid, then that's a problem.
I'm glad those are your words, not mine.
Well, if this is just an accidental result, the legislature never thought about it. They wouldn't have written a statute this way. Did you make any attempt to petition the legislature to give you special permission to sue?
No, I did not, Your Honor.
If we were to decide that this were not a jurisdictional matter, but something more appropriate for an affirmative defense subject to summary judgment, would we reach that issue?
I believe it would be appropriate to reach the issue that there is a denial of equal protection, whether or not it's considered to be a jurisdictional issue or a non-jurisdictional. My point on the jurisdictional issue is that the hallmark of jurisdictional issues or statutes are exhaustion requirements, as this court stated in Essenberg when it overruled the
fifth. But we would only be doing it as a matter of sort of practicality, because if we found that it was not a jurisdictional matter, it would go back to the trial court to decide the issue, right?
That's right, Your Honor.
We wouldn't have to address it, but we could choose to.
Well, the matter has been decided by the trial court about five years before it chose to bring its plea to the jurisdiction. The matter was raised by summary judgment by the state and denied by Judge Gottlieb at that time. And in fact, what he, in his opinion at the trial level, he called it the order denying the so-called plea to the jurisdiction, because he effectively treated the plea as a motion for reconsideration of the denial for summary judgment. The dilemma that I believe that we're all confronted with is that under Texas law, when a Texas precedent establishes quite clearly that when the legislator uses the words individual or person, it did not intend those words to be construed to include an unborn fetus. So contrary to every other single class of persons, such as mentally incompetent or people who are misdiagnosed with cancer only to find out 5 years later that they have a terminal illness, the unborn fetus is in a special class, in a special category that is really singled out and effectively deprived of the right that every other single Texas citizen has, which is to bring a claim under the Texas Tort Claims Act, assuming that they can comply with the notice provision. And by definition, a fetus injured in the first trimester pregnancy is precluded from such an effort. And I believe that is perhaps the essence of the constitutional issue. I'm not urging that this is an open court violation, because it's somewhat questionable in the various proceedings whether or not the Texas Tort Claims Act revives a common law cause of action or in fact creates it. I believe that Justice Livingston, in dissent in the Crider case, she obviously took that position that it was just a revival. But I don't think this court needs to go that far and treat this as an open courts violation.
But again, the troubling thing here is that you say this the way this works, it falls unfairly on fetuses, because obviously they can't get notice. May not even know, they don't even know that it's happened. But yet you're not troubled if the legislature just said we're not going to have these claims at all. Then it would not just work an unfairness, it would be determination. We're not going to have these claims.
Well, actually, I don't. If I said that, perhaps I may have misunderstood.
Well, we should clear that up. Yeah. I ask you, did you think that the state could just refuse to waive immunity from suits for injuries to fetuses?
I think they could, but I think we'd be back before Your Honors asking you to declare that.
Oh, you mean they could, just like they can do anything, but
yes, right.
They couldn't do it and get away with it.
That's right.
And you say today that your case is really equal protection, more than open courts.
Yes, I believe
that
it is.
Your brief doesn't really talk about equal protection. Are there cases out there about a state's choice to make a limited waiver of its immunity as violating either state or federal equal protection?
Well, the Sullivan case, that was the let me just quickly check my notes around this. Sullivan versus UIL. It's a 1981 decision by this court that dealt with the student transfer rules, and the issue was the blanket proscription of the ability of students transferring to different high schools, and their preclusion from participating in athletics was deemed to be a violation of the Equal Protection Act. The holding was that with respect to the purpose and the rules, they made no provision that distinguished legitimate transferred athletes from those who were recruited for purposes of participating in athletics. And my only comment on that, I happen to think that that was a very good decision. My only comment on that would be that comparing the facts of these two cases, this is a much stronger position because there is absolutely no basis for to achieve the purpose of the act, which is to prevent frivolous claims, to settle claims or prepare for trial. It serves no purpose to deny the unborn child access to the courts in the limited fashion that the state has prescribed.
Did our court discuss sovereign immunity in UIL? Because frequently the law is, position is frequently taken that UIL is a private organization.
Yeah, no, they did not discuss sovereign immunity in that context, Your Honor. It was just it was the analysis dealt with the issue of equal protection and the kinds of thoughts that go into equal protection. And here, rather than being a transferred athlete, this is a matter of biology. I mean, the length of human pregnancy being 9 months, by definition, this is a child that was incapable of meeting the notice provision. And that does not serve the purpose of the notice provision. There's no rational justification for this particular subclass of Texas citizens to be deprived. That would be the essence of my argument on the equal rights aspect, of the equal protection aspect.
And your subclass is all unborn children or unborn children? Well, your first argument, as I understand it, is that the injury didn't occur until birth.
That's right.
You can't injure someone who's not a person. And so then we don't reach any constitutional issues. But if there is an injury on the date that this incident happened, then your argument is automatically any unborn children, or is it unborn children whose parents or future guardians don't have the ability to know they've been injured because of the nature of the incident?
In my mind, even with Kreider, and I think adopting Judge Godbee's point of view, Kreider, arguably, there was an adult present that could have represented the interests of the child. A child, say, for example, that's injured in the last trimester of pregnancy, at least they'll have 30 to 45 days to scramble around and provide notice if that is what this court would require. But the first trimester injured child, by definition, is precluded automatically from participating in this statutory scheme.
How is that different from a child who's injured in utero the last month before it's born, but the injury is not ascertainable until the child is about a year old? I mean, how is that different?
I don't believe it is different, because we're thinking in terms of fairness, but assuming that the legislature has a purpose of preventing claims from being brought and fulfilling the purpose of the statute, which is to promote settlement and prepare for trial, arguably the second child has someone that can represent their interest because they're at least in existence under.
It's undisputed that it's not possible to diagnose the injury. The injury doesn't develop until the child is a year old.
But there is some case law to that effect that says basically tough, coming from the various courts of appeals.
But how is that in equal protection terms? How is that different?
Well, it's different in only in the sense of the impossibility aspect of it. I mean, in one, there is some possibility.
In my example, there's no possibility that can be diagnosed until the child is here. No.
I mean, I would agree that would be an unfair situation. And if I were an attorney representing such a child, I would be arguing similarly before Your Honor at the present time if that would be an unjust result. But I'm I'm not there. I mean, I'm somewhat.
But unjust is one thing. I guess that's what I struggle with is the legislature has only waived sovereign immunity in certain instances. For example, the use of tangible personal property. I mean, you could argue that precisely the same kind of injury could occur by the negligence of the state. It just so happens they didn't use tangible personal property that caused it. It's certainly unfair that one plaintiff can recover and the other can't. But is that an equal protection violation?
Well, I believe it elevates to an equal protection when you have the situation that we have presently, which is, by definition, no one can ever recover.
In my example, by definition, you can't recover.
Yes, I understand the distinction, but that's an individual situation. I mean, this is what I'm thinking right now, and I haven't really clearly thought. What we're talking about is a subclass. We're talking about all children that are injured in the first trimester of pregnancy are automatically precluded from participating under the Texas Tort Claims Act by definition. The fact that there may be a harsh result or two or three or four elsewhere can't be my focus at the present, and I'm not providing enlightenment on that. I don't agree with the way that the harshness has been applied in other situations. For example, in the Stanton case out of Dallas, the young man had stored his sperm because he had testicular cancer to go back 5 years later and find that the state had thrown it out, and he was left without a remedy. So that was a harsh application of the act insofar as he was concerned. But here we're talking about the distinction being an entire subclass of Texas citizens.
And what level of scrutiny do you claim we should apply in analyzing your equal protection argument?
But I think it's certainly a quasi-suspect class, but even if it's not, if a non-suspect class is determined, and perhaps unborn children are in that category, the court must look at the rationale, the reason for the existence of the notice provision, which is, again, the three things I've mentioned already, evaluating frivolous claims, promoting settlement, and preparing for trial. How can the state, in fact, do such a thing if there is no child or person in existence?
Any other questions?
Yes, one other question. We focused you entirely on whether this should be a requirement at all. What difference does it make to you if it is a requirement, whether it's a jurisdictional requirement or just one that you're going to lose on?
I've asked myself that a lot because obviously I'm from out of state, and it took me a while to get up to speed to understand the nature of the jurisdictional issue. But I believe, and I think we had some earlier discourse, I don't think there is a distinction in terms of the test that should be applied, although the exhaustion requirements are usually the hallmark of a jurisdictional statute, such as in Essenberg. And I don't believe that this particular notice provision is an exhaustion exhaustion component. It's simply a notice saying that we're presenting this claim for your consideration.
But from your perspective, whether you lose by a plea to the jurisdiction or a motion for summary judgment, it doesn't really matter.
It doesn't matter. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Surely, the State Tort Claims Act is subject to equal protection analysis if an attack is properly made, or not?
I don't think that's a safe assumption, Your Honor, because as the court recognized in Wichita Falls State Hospital, sovereign immunity is of constitutional consequences. And because it is of, as Alexander Hamilton wrote in Federalist 81, it is something that the states enjoyed when they entered the Union.
If the state legislature said only one sex or only one racial group could bring a suit against the state, that'd be fine?
I think in that case, it is possible that because that would be subjected to higher scrutiny.
So rational scrutiny, only people north of the Brazos River can sue. That's okay?
If it were rational basis scrutiny, yes. I can't see how.
Well, but you've conceded. The first question was, is the Tort Claims Act subject to equal protection? You said you're not sure. And then the next question was, well, but you surely can't discriminate on the basis of race or gender. And you said, surely not. So now it does apply.
I think you would probably have to make an exception to the inherent doctrine of sovereign immunity to permit an equal protection claim under any circumstances.
So you would say that the equal protection provision only applies for suspect classes but not others? Or are we back at rational basis?
I think we're actually back at answer one. I apologize, Your Honor, which is that it probably shouldn't ever apply under any circumstances. Now, the court could create an exception if it wished to, where the other doctrines say that the court should exercise very strict scrutiny over the circumstances. But because sovereign immunity is an inherently constitutional matter, it doesn't seem that the founders intended sovereign immunity to be amenable to be forced to waive sovereign immunity because of another constitutional doctrine, or else they would have written
so. The legislature could waive it only as to people who vote in one political party primary.
Based on the doctrine of sovereign immunity, it appears that could be the case.
How do you address their argument that because a fetus is not a person until a live birth, then there can't be an injury or incident regarding a person until that time? Because that would take care of the entire notice argument.
Well, this court actually already decided that question in Brown versus Schwartz, in which the court wrote that the statute of limitations begins to run at the time of the injury inside the womb. So therefore, the injury occurred inside the womb. That the cause of action only accrues after the child is born, but the injury occurred inside the womb.
And the notice statute is written in terms of incident.
That's correct. The notice statute actually isn't written in terms of injury. It's written in terms of the incident alleged to have caused the injury. So even if you change the definition of injury and said that in some way an injury could never occur inside the womb, it still wouldn't comply with the notice provision because it says the incident alleged to have caused the injury. I'd like to follow up, if I may, on a few questions. On Justice Jefferson's question that I don't believe I fully responded to with regard to whether the statute expressly states the consequences of noncompliance, it also does not do so in the use and property requirements of the Tort Claims Act. So the court has already decided that the statute doesn't have to specifically state what the consequence of noncompliance is for something to be jurisdictional. I'd also like to follow up on one of your questions to my opponent, Justice Hecht, which is, could the legislature accept fetuses from the notice provision? And I think that's the remedy that the other side is asking for, and that actually might invoke equal protection concerns, because then the legislature would be creating a class of persons for whom they are treating differently. So that would actually create the equal protection concerns where there are none now, because it, as Justice Owen pointed out, all persons are discriminated against if they cannot learn of their injury. Moreover, a fetus in this case actually could present if the parents of the fetus knew of the injury or knew of the incident alleged to have caused the injury. The parents or an attorney could give notice. Now, that wouldn't mean the cause of action accrued at that time. It just means the notice provision would have been satisfied. So a fetus technically could satisfy the notice provision even before it was born.
I have one quick question. I may be wrong about this, but I don't think the Attorney General's office has weighed in the case we're hearing today, Martinez, the third case, on whether there are provisions in the Civil Practice and Remedies Code and other provisions that waive or toll limitations for minors and for those under disabilities, whether that has any applicability to the notice provisions of the Tort Claims Act.
It shouldn't, Your Honor, because the Tort Claims Act specifically states that it doesn't permit tolling. If the legislature wanted the Tort Claims Act to have a tolling provision, it could have written that in, and it did not do so in the Tort Claims Act. So therefore, the inherent doctrines of common law or another provision wouldn't toll the notice provision. And more specifically, I believe they do so with regard to statute of limitations, not this notice provision. So even technically, they wouldn't apply.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first clause. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.